You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Okay, so now what do American companies do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 29th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The legal analysis of this morning's Supreme Court ruling striking down race-based affirmative action in higher education is better handled elsewhere. The political analysis also better handled elsewhere. The business and economic analysis, well, better handled here. Something like 70 major corporations, American Express, Apple, and Procter & Gamble among them, signed on to an amicus brief in these cases, urging the court to uphold affirmative action. Quoting the brief here, promoting student body diversity on university campuses remains compelling from a business perspective. So we got economist Peter Blair Henry on the phone to talk it over. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, also dean emeritus at the NYU Stern School of Business. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Kai.
When you heard about this ruling, which many people expected, what was your gut reaction, first of all?
Well, wasn't surprised. This is long expected. And my first reaction is, as an economist, I'm a trained economist, I think about things from that perspective. But also having been dean of a business school for a good part of my life and working with many corporations, I think about it from the perspective of business. So if you think about what we teach in our textbooks and what Milton Friedman said in 1970, corporations, what do they do? Corporations basically exist to maximize profits. They do other things, but primarily the role of the corporation is to maximize its profits for its owners and its shareholders. And how do corporations do that? Well, they do that by, hiring a CEO, and the CEO then makes sure that he or she has a team around them that generates high performance. And there's a lot of data at this point, a lot of studies that show that diverse teams outperform non-diverse teams. And so the ruling is going to remove one instrument that institutions of higher education have to produce diverse classes of graduates, is going to make it harder for businesses to generate the diverse teams they need to generate the performance they need to drive the profits that it is their mission to generate.
You are quoted in an amicus brief in this case as saying this: it is a significant competitive handicap if these businessmen and women have not been in an educational environment exposing them to people from diverse backgrounds. What do you suppose, then, and I ask you this as a guy who sits on corporate boards and a guy who ran a business school, you were the dean at Stern for a number of years, now what are you going to do?
Well, if you're a CEO trying to solve this problem, how do I create high-performing teams with a pipeline that's going to be potentially less diverse than it was in the future, I've got to think about new instruments, because in the past, I could just simply rely on institutions of higher education to produce that pipeline of diverse talent that I was going to need. So universities are going to need time to figure out how they are going to hit their goals. Mm-hmm. And so corporations are also going to have to solve that problem, because they can't rely on institutions of higher education to provide them the talent for those high performance diverse work teams.
So look, do you think companies in America are prepared and equipped to do that? Because if you think back 3 years to George Floyd and the promises that corporate America made on diversity, equity, inclusion, there has not been the progress one might have expected. And I guess I wonder now, with this ruling, if companies really have what it takes.
It's a wake-up call for sure. And companies are going to have to get even more serious and think about how they can find the talent. And again, go back to the point, right? The main point is that we know that diverse teams outperform non-diverse teams. That is an observed fact. So given those observed facts, and leaders of corporations are paid very well to deal with facts, they're going to have to find new ways to produce high-performing teams. And I don't think that the old ways of approaching things are going to cut it. Because to put it to your point, Kai, in the system that previously existed, even in the years after the George Floyd incident, we know that there has not been as much progress as would be desired in the aftermath of George Floyd. Without the constraint that's now in place, the job's going to be harder, not easier than it was before.
You were, when you were at Stanford, you were a professor of international economics. You're now a fellow at an Institute for International Economics. You study it. You work on it. You're a practitioner of it. Does this ruling put American companies at a competitive disadvantage globally?
My sense is yes. This ruling takes away a tool that higher education has to help produce the talent that produces higher performing work teams for American companies. So American companies are going to have to work harder to produce the teams that have the diversity of thought that is necessary to frankly compete in the global economy. So just to be very specific about it, if you're trying to sell goods, services, right, to clients overseas, who are by definition in different societies than you are, then you need to be able to empathize and take their point of view in order to outcompete your competitors who are also trying to sell those folks. And one of the ways in which America has been very successful in outcompeting our global rivals, American companies have been successful, is by producing teams, again, going back to the research, more diverse teams outperform non-diverse teams in corporations. Why? Because you put around the table to making decisions a wide range of viewpoints so that you can get to better competitive answers. And that job is not going to be harder.
Peter Blair Henry is at Hoover at Stanford, used to run the business school at Stern at NYU. Peter, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
The fortunes of corporate America as Wall Street traders saw them today were mostly positive. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been a spate of bank news the past couple of days. The Federal Reserve says the country's biggest banks and the biggest of the not small regional banks did all right on their most recent stress tests. What would happen finance-wise if the worst happens? And Jay Powell had some things to say about banking regulation at a symposium in Madrid today. Parenthetically, central bankers get around, I guess. Anyway, Powell opined that the Fed might have to beef up its oversight, specifically given the speed at which Silicon Valley Bank failed. Depositors jumping online and yanking their deposits in seconds. These are not your grandfather's bank runs the Fed is dealing with here, and it is always hard for regulators to keep up with technology. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
You and I can transfer money anytime online, but if a bank wants to use the Federal Reserve for a wire transfer, it has to be done pretty much during normal business hours, Monday through Friday.
That's been a running joke among people for a while.
Catherine Judge teaches law at Columbia University.
A lot of the Fed's operations are used to operating on business hours, as opposed to being able to work in a 24/7 environment.
There's some speculation the Fed would have been able to save Silicon Valley Bank if it could have wired the bank money right away. So yeah, Judge says, the Fed should update its infrastructure, but not at the expense of basic bank regulation. That's what SVB needed, according to Itamar Drexler, a finance professor at Wharton. He says SVB's problems wouldn't have been solved by an instant Fed bailout.
Suppose that SVB would have taken 2 weeks to fail rather than overnight. Would that have made this okay? I don't think so.
The Fed released the results of its stress tests of the biggest 23 banks yesterday. They're doing fine. But Gregor Matvos, who teaches finance at Northwestern, says there are as many as 190 mid-sized banks that could fail just as suddenly as SVB.
What technology is going to do is it won't give the regulators much time once the bank is in a danger zone. So you have to prevent the bank from ever entering to a danger zone in the first place.
How do you do that? Good old-fashioned bank regulation, more audits, and higher capital requirements, extra resources these banks could turn to in an emergency. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Gallon of gas today, regular, on average across the country, $3.54. A year ago, says AAA, $4.86. And you might remember back then that we on this program and others elsewhere pointed out that the problem largely was refining capacity, not having enough of it. As this economy finally started to pull itself out of the worst of the pandemic, refiners couldn't simply turn enough crude oil into gas, diesel, and jet fuel to meet rising demand. But as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, that shortage of capacity does seem to be in the rearview mirror.
The Chevron refinery in the L.A. suburb of El Segundo is a sprawling complex of heavy equipment and tanks that spans 1,000 acres, pretty much right next to the beach.
We are one of the largest refineries on the West Coast. We have a rated capacity of 290,000 barrels per day.
Jeff Wilson, a corporate affairs manager at Chevron, says when the pandemic hit, they were suddenly refining a whole lot less than that.
We had to reconfigure this plant quickly. All of a sudden, people weren't flying. Jet fuel demand just collapsed.
Many of us weren't driving much either.
But at the same time, the refineries needed to continue to run.
Chevron's refinery here bounced back as demand came back. But since 2020, a half dozen other refineries in the U.S. have shut down. At the start of last year, refining capacity hit an eight-year low. Tracy Shuchart, founder of Hill Tower Resource Advisors, says that's when everybody started traveling again.
You had all this demand hit the market that wasn't really prepared for.
Since then, refiners have added capacity at existing facilities, and profits are growing, which is attracting more investment to the industry. Bob McNally, president of Rapidan Energy Group, says that'll make a difference to consumers.
Energy is not something like, movie tickets or Chipotle or something. It's not a want-to-have, it's a must-have.
And McNally says all that added capacity could help shield against price spikes down the road. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm a little Barbied out for now.
Yeah, I get that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 269 today, 0.8%, closed at 34,122. The NASDAQ flat 13,591. S&P 500 up 19 points, about 0.4%, 43.96. Nancy Marshall-Genzer was telling us about the Fed and bank regulation, so let's check on a couple of Kai, we're going to check in on a couple of bank stocks. How about that? JPMorgan Chase added 3.5% today. Bank of America tacked on 2.1%. Citigroup found about 0.1% in the couch cushions. AAA is expecting a record number of travelers this coming holiday weekend, so how's about we take a peek at airline stocks? Delta down 0.8%. United down 4.5%. American up about 0.3%. Southwest, just for good measure, up about 1.3% there. Bond prices went down. When that happens, the yield goes up. In this case, the 10-year at 3.84%. Also up, by the way, 30-year fixed rate mortgages, 7% again. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Consider for a moment the food you eat. Well, not so much the food you eat, but the foodstuffs that you don't eat. Organic waste is the term of art. Now, I want you to consider climate change. Methane is one of the worst of the greenhouse gases. Organic waste is a big source of methane. And what happens when that food, organic waste, doesn't have access to oxygen, like in a landfill, is that it releases methane as it rots. So enter now composting. There are states that have organic waste collection laws, but it turns out that getting those food scraps from kitchens to treatment facilities and then eventually to farms to be used, it is complicated and it is a business opportunity. From KCRW here in Los Angeles, Kaylee Wells follows along.
On Trash Pickup Day, my green bin is full of orange peels, carrot tops, eggshells, and brown paper bags. The truck that picks it up looks just like a regular trash truck, and it carts it to a compost facility called Recology, 100 miles north to Bakersfield.
These are the City of LA trucks right here that are offloading right now.
Recology's general manager, Charbel E., drives me around the vast facility. A lot of Angelino's food scraps end up here. Los Angeles spent more than $1.6 billion on compost contracts with Recology and other companies. It sounds like a lot, but the city spent more than double that on its most recent trash hauling contracts. And this is LA. My 4 million neighbors and I make a lot of waste.
We're generating about 1,800 tons a day.
Alex Halu with LA Sanitation Department says the biggest obstacle now is getting residents to actually use those green bins.
In the city of Los Angeles, our goal right now is to increase the 1,800 tons a day to 3,000 tons a day.
And it's a good thing that LA is ahead of some of its neighbors because starting next year, California will fine cities that don't comply. The state wants to divert the organic waste heading to landfills by an ambitious 75% in the next 2 years. When my orange peels and eggshells get here, they end up in a big pile along with chicken bones and tree branches and garden scraps. It smells like, well, rotting food. The pile also includes some things that shouldn't be here. A worker in a construction helmet, a reflector vest, and thick gloves wanders around and plucks out the milk cartons and garden hoses that mistakenly ended up in the green bins, as Recology GM Charbel Eid explains.
Anything that's bigger that he can physically see, he's going to pull out and move it out of the way, and then that's what you see.
Then the pile moves on to its next stop, the shredder. Its job is to chop up bigger pieces of waste, like tree branches and that paper bag I threw in my bin. The food waste pile then gets pushed into long rows of organic waste. Each row is twice as tall as I am and can stretch as long as 7 football fields. Every few days, the rows are turned and oxygenated so the waste can break down into compost.
And at about the 90-day mark is when we'll pull it, we'll bring it up to our screen plant, and then we'll start to screen it.
Anything larger than a quarter inch gets sifted out. This is where Recology catches those plastic produce stickers that I might have forgotten to pull off my orange peels. The result is moist, almost black, rich compost.
Now, if you're a farmer or a gardener, holy cats, man, that looks yummy to you.
Recology's PR manager, Robert Reed, says there are huge benefits to this months-long process.
Composting program saves landfill space, it reduces methane emissions.
Good for the environment, but also good for agriculture.
Compost improves soil health. That helps with growing more food, which equals food security, and it helps save water.
Oh, and that moldy, stinky food smell? Totally gone. Now the compost just smells like wet dirt, and it's loaded into a commercial dump truck and then heads to a farm down the road, where a tractor and spreader moves through an almond orchard, shooting compost over the base of the trees. Recology estimates more than 95% of its compost is used on local farms. So all those food scraps my neighbors and I dump into our green bins help grow the next generation of food. In Bakersfield, California, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
This week that in May, 20% more new homes were sold than were sold in May a year ago, so says the Commerce Department. We also learned recently that a new Barbie dream house is sold every 2 minutes, so says Mattel. That is a lot of real estate. And of course, Barbie doesn't have to deal with the vagaries of the actual housing market, but just as life imitates art, sometimes it imitates toys too, and vice versa. Anna Kode is a real estate reporter with the New York Times who spent some time revisiting the Barbie dream house of old. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Real estate reporter though you are, how did you come to do a story on the Barbie dream house?
Before I was a real estate reporter, I was a styles reporter. So I'm kind of wired to think about the real estate angle of whatever's happening in pop culture. And when it comes to Barbie, of course, the answer to that is dream house.
Yeah, and it kind of doesn't get any better than this, right? Style and real estate merging in the Barbie dream house?
Yeah, it's a dream come true.
No pun intended. So here's the thing, though, and obviously we'll talk about the house and the piece because it's totally interesting. But you know, we as a society have put Barbie through our own psychological lenses for, like, what, 60-something years now that she's been around. Not so much the house.
Exactly, and that was kind of the premise of this story, to give that same lens of deep critical thinking to what the dream house represents as well. And there was a lot to unpack there, from design trends to how it reflected whatever was going in society, or whatever it chose to ignore as well said something about it too.
Well, so let's get to the first one, right? Comes out in 1962. Describe it for me, would you?
So the 1962 dream house is a single room, yellow walled ranch home, and it looks like a studio apartment. It's really quite quaint if you look at it today, but it's probably what you would think of when you think your first apartment out of college or something in the big city. And to me, the most fascinating part of it is that it has no kitchen, and a lot of dollhouses at the time were made with the purpose of teaching young girls domestic tasks like cooking and cleaning and all of that. But here, this was just about Barbie having fun in her own home.
We should point out here the idea in 1962 of a woman, or a minority for that matter, just to take it a little bit afield, having access to the credit needed to buy a home was not entirely reality-based.
Right. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act wasn't passed until 1974. So in 1962, it was really common for a bank to turn down a mortgage for a woman just because she was a woman or because she was single or divorced. So this toy represented something that young girls didn't really see in the real world very often.
The next one you come to is the 1979 version. By this time, Barbie's in the suburbs, right? But still a single woman owning a house. The house, Ken, as you point out in this piece, Ken is not on the deed anywhere.
No, it's still Barbie's house, and they're getting bigger and more glamorous. The 1990 house in particular looks so much like a Mink Mansion. It has these huge columns, these big double doors, and that's the era when Americans are really obsessed with houses being bigger and more showy and flashy and everything.
We should point out here that this first of all, it's a toy, right? So it's not supposed to be reality-based, but it's not reality-based in terms of what's going on with housing reality at times. In 2008, right, we have the housing crash. Mattel sort of doesn't, you know, acknowledge the reality of that.
I mean, who wants their toy to represent right. the housing crisis? It's kind of right. a nice counter to that. But they do acknowledge other things, like they acknowledge the pandemic in 2021. You have Barbie having her own work-from-home station in the house.
Yeah, no, I love that. That was great. She's up on the tiny bedroom on the third floor, just doing her thing. So what do you make of this? I mean, look, you're an experienced real estate reporter, and you're a style reporter. What's your takeaway?
Oh my gosh, there's a lot to take away from here. But when a toy lasts for 60 years, it can really show you so much of how things have changed over time. On one side, you can look for design trends, right? But if you take a look deeper, you can really see policy or inequality reflected in the toy too. And I think this could probably be extended to almost any object and see how it reflected the times over any number of years.
Okay, so look, you're going to see the movie or what?
I guess so. I'm a little Barbied out for now, but I don't know how I can avoid it.
Anna Coday, she's a real estate reporter at the New York Times. Anna, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, saw this in the Wall Street Journal. You can add financial regulators to the list of those firmly opposed to the use of emojis. The paper reports that the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which is kind of a self-regulatory body for Wall Street broker-dealers, they are looking at how financial firms communicate in writing, and in particular, how texts and emails that contain a smiley face or a thumbs down or whatever other emoji you can think of might be easy to misinterpret, shall we say, or ambiguous and thus problematic. Because, come on, how many times have you looked at a text and said, wait, what are you talking about? All right, for your moment of economic context today, I report, you decide. We got the last and most refined update on first quarter economic growth this morning. You've probably heard or seen this already today. GDP, gross domestic product, grew at an annualized rate of 2%. New Year's through April Fool's Day, that's up from an earlier guess of 1.3%. But, and again, that is almost completely due to you, the consumer. Consumer spending up 4.2% in Q1. I honestly don't know how y'all do it. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Card, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I don't know how they do it either. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.